This is the current federal tax developments for the week of April the 11th, 2016. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs. This week on the April 11th edition of Current Federal Tax Developments, we're going to look at the following interesting and key issues related to us by the developments this week. First, the IRS is going to formally disagree with the tax court view on the taxability of a tax advisor damage award. We'll talk about an IRS informal letter that indicated additional conditions under which an employer could receive a refund of an erroneous contribution to an employee's health savings account. The IRS issues revised depreciation limits and lease inclusion amounts for autos for 2015 and 16, required by the Protecting Americans Against Tax Hike Act of 2015. We'll talk about an IRS private letter ruling that allowed a trust to enter into an agreement of interpretation of its terms under state law to qualify as a qualified subchapter S trust and make the election. We'll discuss a IRS email that talked about the impact of an omitted gift on the omitted gift statute limitation rules and whether that has an impact on years after the year in which the gift was made. And finally, the IRS gets a lesson in dicta as the tax court decides that they didn't really mean what they said in an earlier case, but since it wasn't relevant to the decision in the earlier case, well, that means we're not really changing our mind. Therefore, they rule differently. So let's get ourselves rolling. Now, of course, as most of you are probably aware, this is the first week of tax season, or not the first week, last week. Let's try not to restart. We probably don't want to get going back there. And we're all probably kind of worn out, sleeping, you know, sleepy, doing stuff. And I realize that a few of you may very well be listening to this now after the end of tax season, because it's really sad if you're listening to this on the 19th of April when you have nothing better to do. But nevertheless, some of us will be going. For those of you who are listening during this week, go ahead, get your rest, and it's going to be a really interesting week. Let's go ahead then and get started. We're going to first start with Action on Decision 2016-01 that was issued on the 4th of April. This is where the IRS officially announced its disagreement with the tax court's holding in the case of Cosentino versus Commissioner, a 2014 tax court memo decision, TC Memo 2014-186. In that particular case, the tax court found that damages paid to a taxpayer by an advisor were not taxable. What had happened in the case was the taxpayer had a building they were going to get rid of at a substantial gain. A tax advisor selling a marketed tax shelter approached them and said, "Hey guys, we've got this wonderful plan for you. We're going to get you into this partnership that's going to create this large capital loss and is going to offset your gain." This particular taxpayer previously had always done 1031 exchanges whenever they were selling real estate, so they hadn't really paid tax in the past on the gains, but hey, you know, they thought this would be a good idea. We could get out of the real estate. We could basically take our cash, and we have this large loss. Well, unfortunately, a little after entering into the transaction, the taxpayers discovered that the IRS wasn't thrilled with this transaction, discovered it was being the IRS was going after these. The taxpayer went back, amended their returns, paid the tax in question, and then sued the advisor. The advisor paid damages based upon that tax that had been paid by the taxpayer in the transaction. The question that arose at this point was, were those damages taxable to the taxpayer? Generally, under rules that you're going to find, as are discussed in the write-up in the materials we have for this case, the general rule in these cases, as you'll see from the citations in the materials, revolves around whether or not the tax in question was one that, in essence, would not have been paid had the taxpayer had, let's say, a return been done properly. The standard case that goes back many years looked at a case where a tax preparer had prepared a married filing separate return, and when, in fact, a married filing joint return would have been preferable. The statute of limitations had closed before the error was discovered. The court determined that the differences, the damages for having fouled up your determination of filing status, that those damages were non-taxable because it just put the taxpayer back in the position they would have been in had, in fact, the return been done properly. They contrast that with a case where a taxpayer maybe, you know, sold an asset because somebody told him it wouldn't be taxable, and then suddenly discovered that it was. And the court said, well, in that case, the problem was you entered into a transaction and taxes be due. There was nothing wrong. You know, the transaction you entered into was a taxable transaction. Therefore, when you're paid the money back, that's considered taxable. The IRS said, well, this sounds a lot like the latter case. But the taxpayer in this case said, wait, we had had a lifetime plan to use Section 1031 exchanges to always defer our gains. And we had a long history of doing so. Therefore, had we not been given the bum advice, we would have entered into a 1031 exchange. The IRS said, wait, tax court, you've rejected the idea of we would have done something different in the past because that's been used as a defense. We could have found some way to save the tax. The court said no in this case because it wasn't just a theoretical we could have done, we would have done something different. The evidence strongly suggested the taxpayer would exactly have entered into a 1031 exchange. Therefore, they held that the amount was non-taxable. The IRS this week issued an action on decision that makes it clear they will not go along with this decision. So I wouldn't suggest that you raise that particular defense or expect some pushback if you do. The IRS points out that, in fact, the taxpayer really was still in a better economic position. They had cash rather than a real estate. They could do what they want. They also, in passing, in a footnote, which was kind of funny, they kind of buried the lead. They indicated in the footnote that they simply disagreed with the theory that you could use a lifetime plan defense. Now, that honestly was a major holding in this case, which they don't like. And they didn't cite any specific authority for why a lifetime plan method wasn't a valid interpretation. They just don't believe it is. But the key takeaway from this, because it's not acquiesced, is the IRS does plan to challenge this. So if you have a taxpayer that's trying to claim that damage awards from an advisor are non-taxable, you may find that the IRS is going to balk. The other problem is advisors that end up with awards against them may discover that plaintiff's attorneys are going to want larger awards or larger amounts to settle, presuming it'll be taxable because of the thought that unless your case fits the narrow exclusion of something like you fouled up and told them to file the wrong filing status and the statute closed, the problem is that they're going to presume it's taxable. And obviously, to make them whole, their theory will be we need larger damages. So be aware of that side of it as well. Next up, we're going to take a look at an IRS informal letter the tax analyst published this week. It was a letter to UMB Bank and the American Bankers Association. The letter was actually written last September, but tax analysts obtained it this week. The issue in this case involved questions of when an employer could receive money from a health savings account for an employee if it made a contribution to that account in error. Now, back in 2008, the IRS had issued Notice 2008-59 to deal with a lot of HSA issues, but two particular questions related to this employer refund problem were addressed in Notice 2008-59, actually a few of issues. A couple of things it said. Question answer 23 said, if employer contributed more than the maximum contribution to an HSA allowed for an employee, then you could remove it. But the maximum they're talking about here is the maximum per statute, not just they contributed more than what the employer meant to contribute under the program, but that they contributed in excess. So let's say they put $10,000 in the account. That's well in excess, regardless of single or family coverage, of your allowed HSA contribution. They could ask for that to be refunded. The IRS also ruled if the under question answer 24, if the employee had never been an eligible individual. That is, they had never had a high deductible health plan and they had not established an HSA while they had that. Then the employer could take the funds back because there was no valid HSA in place. However, they noted that if the employee had been an eligible individual in the past and had established an HSA and then ceased to be eligible, let's say they ended up with other disqualifying coverage, the employer could not reach in and grab the balance in that case. Now, a couple of problems, obviously. People began to worry, and employers who are making these contributions were worried that those were the only criteria under which they could reach back in. And so the UMB Bank and the American Bankers Association wrote a letter, kind of asked the IRS to clarify this. The IRS makes clear in this notice, which is authored for the IRS by Henry Becker, Chief Health and Welfare Branch of the Office of the Associate Chief Counsel of the IRS. He indicates right off that notice 2008-59's list is not meant to be exhaustive. In fact, he goes on, and in the materials you're going to find, he lists a number of specific conditions where, due to administrative error, the wrong amount may go in, and he says the bank is authorized to send that back. Why is this a concern? Because under 223, which is the section of the code that authorizes HSAs, anything that goes into an HSA is supposed to be non-forfeitable. Obviously, without some backup, the banks and sponsor, the banks and the custodians were a little leery of sending anything back out because they could face a challenge from the owner of the HSA that they had no authority to reach in and grab that. Now they're going to say, yes, in these conditions you do. The reason why employers were so worried about this was, aside from the fact of maybe having put too much in for somebody that they got to keep, there is the problem to remember of the comparable contribution rule. Under the comparable contribution rule, which we find here in the Internal Revenue Code, if you are an employer who sponsors, who pays for HSA balances, who basically makes his HSA contributions on behalf of your employees, if you don't make comparable contributions to all eligible employees, then you owe 35% on all the contributions you made. The problem there is, let's say you put $100 more in the account than you should have, because let's say you doubled up on one payroll by accident for this employee, and so because of that, $100 too much went in. Now, your problem is, under the rules, it would appear, that you would have to go back and actually catch up in this case and issue a 30 under 4980G. If you didn't want to pay the 35%, you would presumably have to go back and put that extra amount or percentage in everybody's account to keep from having a problem. This ruling allows you a way to not have that problem. Next up, well, another fallout of the PATH bill comes up this time, and the more traditional thing, but the reason for the delay this year was the PATH bill, Revenue Procedure 2016-23, issued on April the 1st. The IRS published the revised rates for 2015 for luxury auto limits. Now, the only revision here is the additional first-year bonus, not exactly something you needed to spend a lot of time worrying about because we all knew how much to add back. But if you want the formal numbers, now those tables are there. It also published the revised lease inclusion amounts for 2015. So those tables also are in there in revised forms. This is something they did a year ago. They also published the 2016 numbers. Now, the good news is this year, because the bonus depreciation doesn't disappear at the end of the year, this year we don't have the same problem of having only a set of tables for non-bonus automobiles and then have to go back and wait for a bonus one to come out later. This year, the numbers, we have both the bonus and non-bonus numbers in there. And as I said, we also got the lease inclusion amounts for 2016. That's in Revenue Procedure 2016-23. Next, we have a couple of private letter rulings that were sought. And this was sought because there were some troublesome issues in trusts that held S corporation stocks and for which a qualified subchapter S trust election was desired to be made by the beneficiaries. The problem in the trust were, when you read the trust documents, and if you read our materials online, which you can download at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, you'll be able to take a look at these provisions. But effectively, the trust provisions said that the trustee could make contributions and would take into consideration for the need of contributions, the needs of the child of the person that founded the trust, and that child's descendants. The problem there is it appeared that that could be interpreted as giving a cause for the children of the child, that is, the descendants, the grandchildren of the original founder of the trust, to raise a claim that they had a right to money in the trust because the trustee needed to make a distribution to dad because dad's kids needed something. And the problem with that is, to be a qualified QSST, there must be one and only one beneficiary who can benefit from the trust during their lifetime. Now, in this case, the state law in question allowed for entering into the trustees and the relevant beneficiaries to enter into a stipulation, an agreement, which would be filed with the state court that had jurisdiction over this trust, and that under state law would be deemed binding, that would deal with the interpretation, proper interpretation, and applications of the terms of the trust. They entered into such an agreement that made it clear that the kids, you know, the grandkids had no rights in the trust, that the, and they also made clear that the trustee would only consider the needs of the parent, you know, in this case, the beneficiary. Having made those revisions, which you can read more about in there, the IRS disruled that that agreement, key issue here, which was valid under state law, that's very important, that that allowed them to make a QSST election. They were qualified to come in and make the election under the trust. As I note, key issue there is you got to have something valid under state law. That means time to bring the attorneys in and time to figure out what you have to do to be valid under state law. But it also means that you have to be very careful if you have a trust that you want to be a qualified subchapter S trust or that may want to make such an election, it's probably best if you look at those terms in details before dad dies and we suddenly discover that we have a problem trust term. In this case, presumably somebody, you know, after dad died, we got the trust documents out. It was decided that we had a problem because remember, we've got 2 years after which we either have to get the S shares out of the trust or we have to make sure the trust is eligible to elect QSST and the beneficiary elects or is eligible to elect the electing small business trust and the trust elects. In this case, obviously, they became concerned afterward that their trust wasn't going to qualify, but they wanted to keep the shares in the trust. This was the final, this was the way they solved that little problem. Next up, email advice from the chief counsel's office. Chief counsel's email, 2016-14036, issued on April the 1st, an April Fool's Day, but not quite the way that's going to work for them, hopefully. The problem became, for those who may not be aware, Internal Revenue Code Section 6501 C9 provides that if you file a Form 709 gift tax return, but you omit a gift from that return, the statute remains open indefinitely to assess the tax on the omitted gift. Merely filing the 709 doesn't mean that the IRS has to find all gifts for that year. If you omitted a gift, in essence, the IRS has an open statute to go after that. The problem, though, when you think about it is, let's say you filed a 709, you omitted a gift, but for that year, even with the omitted gift, you were below the lifetime gifting amount. However, in a subsequent year, let's say you make a gift you think takes you to the lifetime gifting amount, which would be non-taxable. So let's say 2010, we had this omitted gift. We filed a 709, but we missed a $200,000 gift. Then we come back, you know, 2014, and in a later year, 2014, we come back and we max that up, got to our, you know, maximum amount that we could transfer. And so we end up with $200,000 now, even though we thought we got just to the limit, we actually went $200,000 over. Let's also assume the IRS doesn't discover this problem until 2020. Now, the 2010 return is still open to assess the tax there, but there's no tax in 2010 because they didn't go over the limit. 2014, when they made that big gift that they thought took them right to the limit, tax should have been paid. But that year is otherwise closed. The agent was asking, can I go after the 2014 return? In this particular case, the national office looking at these rules, it said, well, we understand how this works, but the problem, they said, is the statute only opens the year for which the gift was actually omitted from the return. So only the 2010 return, for which no tax would have been due, is open. The 2014 return, where you would have owed tax because of prior gifts, can't be touched by the service. Therefore, as they said, the email concluded that it would take an act of Congress to change that rule. And of course, not likely real soon, we're going to see Congress changing that rule. Finally, interesting case important for how you interpret the court decisions. This is the case of Senezen versus Commissioner 146 TC number 9, March 31st, 2016. And this is the case where the IRS discovers that the tax court might not necessarily have meant what they said in an earlier case. and it gives us a chance to look at the importance of understanding the difference between items in a decision that are crucial to the decisions and discussions in a decision that are not relevant to the decision, otherwise known as dicta. In this particular case, Mr. Sensen pled guilty to the criminal charge of tax evasion, that he had embezzled income and omitted it from his tax return. He did that, entered into a plea agreement with the Justice Department, and agreed he had omitted income from his return, pled guilty to tax evasion. Now, as the court discussed, he did that. The Justice Department agreed not to pursue charges against his wife, etc. Okay. Well, that handles a criminal case. Now, of course, what usually happens after a criminal case in a tax evasion case is the IRS now goes after the tax. This is the civil case. In this case, the court looked at what Mr. Sensen brought in. And in the case, the tax court actually found that Mr. Sensen presented evidence that he, in fact, had additional deductions that would have totally offset that income. In fact, it turns out that, as the court said, generally a requirement for evasion of tax is generally that there had to be tax evaded, which generally means that there must be a deficiency. Except the court found that based on the facts in front of it, it didn't see any deficiency. Now, we saw the problem. Mr. Sensen had pled guilty to a criminal charge, which as a key component of that criminal charge was he had an underpayment of tax. The question became, well, isn't the tax court required to find that he owes some tax? In an earlier case, the Anderson case, the tax court had specifically stated, because Mr. Anderson had, you know, the Anderson issue involved a similar taxpayer who had pled guilty to tax evasion. And in passing, the court said the very nature of a tax evasion conviction means that the tax court is required to find some liability, no matter how small, in the civil case, because the taxpayer has agreed that they owed tax. The IRS, pointing to that, said, well, you know, you got to basically uphold a deficiency of some sort against Sensen. But the tax court said, yeah, but all the evidence we got says there is none. So do we have to come up with a number for which we have no idea how to compute? Or were we overstating things in Anderson? And the court decided that, in fact, since this was a real case, because Anderson did not show there would not have been a tax liability. The court said very clearly Anderson had omitted income, owed tax, wasn't even a question. This time, the court said, faced with a real case where a taxpayer presented compelling evidence that, in fact, there was no understatement of tax, the tax court was not compelled to find some sort of understatement simply because he had pled guilty to tax evasion. The key thing to take away from this, as I noted, is the key concept of dicta. Court opinions often go off on discussions of various matters that don't directly impact the decision. That's referred to as dicta. The problem is dicta's not binding on the court, as the IRS discovered in Sensen. You know, basically, that statement, while the court may have believed it at the time, wasn't relevant to the decision. It does not establish any sort of precedent for the court. And it's only good to the extent the analysis is good under the law, which the court decided in this case it wasn't. So it's very important to understand. Now, does that mean you ignore such comments? Generally, no, because the tax court doesn't often totally reverse like it does in this case. But it does mean understanding the very limitations. You have to treat that as more of an analysis conducted by a respected tax expert who came to a conclusion that was stated based on the law. But it doesn't mean that it's binding on the court. It has not the same issue as a ruling that is actually binding on the court, as this one is, by the way, as it's reported, where now it has been held that it is not true as a matter of law that the court must find a deficiency if a taxpayer pleads guilty to tax evasion. In the real world, 99.99% of the times that will happen, but it didn't happen in this case. Because in this case, the court found that, in fact, There was no, you know, it found the evidence suggested there wasn't a deficiency. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of April the 11th. Be sure to listen in to us next week and visit us at our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can sign up there for emails of the articles as we post updates during the week, and you'll get them the next morning after they're posted. You'll also find there, if you just go to the site, you'll actually be able to read these. You'll be able to watch the video of the weekly updates on there. You'll also be able to download the audio from there if you want to download from that site. And you'll also be able, you know, to, you know, take care of all the other neat little things you might want to go read about on there. This podcast, as always, is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs. Be sure to be looking out. Those catalogs should be coming soon. The State Societies will be offering you the training, and we'll be involved here with part of Nichols Patrick in handling those trainings. So be sure to sign up for those courses and be sure to check the catalogs both for our courses and for the other outstanding courses that you'll see offered by the various experts brought in by your states to give these nice full-day sessions. And this has been, for this week, the current federal tax developments. Be sure to join us next week as we come back in and we start talking about what happens in the upcoming week. And next week, happy day, is April 18th. And I realize most of you will probably be watching after that, but we'll go ahead and we'll still try to run something by you for next week to tell you about the updates coming in the area of federal taxes.